17-year-old Norman Ladner grew up in a tight-knit family with two loving parents and six siblings. The eldest son of the bunch, he took it as his responsibility to look out for his siblings, as well as doing what he could to contribute to the family's store and farm. When Norman wasn't helping his family out, there were two true passions that grabbed his attention: woodworking and exploring the vast network of pastures and wooded areas on his family's 122-acre plot of land. Norman would often spend entire days in the woods, exploring the property, watching wildlife, and when he could, he'd squeeze in a little fishing and hunting too. For a boy growing up in rural Mississippi, there was no better way to spend his time, and thanks to all of the hours he'd spent in the wilderness, he knew his family's land better than anyone else. Typically, he'd arrive at his parents' store in the evening to tell them about all the excitement he'd experienced that day. But one warm summer day in 1989, Norman didn't come home. When panic finally set in, Norman's father called a friend, and together they began searching the dense forestry, wielding flashlights against the blackness of the night. For more than an hour they searched, before finally making a horrible discovery. There, in a clearing beside a tree, Norman's father found his body, cold to the touch, with a single gunshot wound to the head. When police arrived, they believed the death had been the result of a terrible accident, but later, that ruling would be changed to suicide. Unable to accept that their son would take his own life, the Ladners conducted their own investigation. This desperate search for answers would lead them into a complex mystery. They felt the sheriff's department had been involved in a cover-up, protecting local drug dealers, which would only be confirmed in their minds when they discovered a bizarre item not far from where Norman's body had been found. Ultimately, when they dug a blood-stained bullet from the earth beneath where their son's head had been laying, they knew someone was hiding the truth. What happened to Norman Ladner? Was this a case of grieving parents who simply couldn't accept that their son may have taken his own life? Or was there truly a cover-up taking place to protect local drug runners, with police getting kickbacks? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 63, The Mysterious Death of Norman Ladner. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. In sticking with October's theme of covering cases that have always disturbed me, today we examine the mysterious death of Norman Ladner. It's a complex story with a lot of different angles and very controversial opinions. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. Subscribe and listen via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcatchers. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at traceevpod, on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you'd like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. Today we examine the mysterious death of Norman Ladner, a heartbreaking story about the loss of a child and the struggle to find the truth, while everyone involved in the investigation believed it was an open and shut case. A lot of questions were raised by Norman's parents, and those questions have never been sufficiently answered. This is Episode 63, The Mysterious Death of Norman Ladner. Norman Charles Ladner was born on May 29, 1972, to parents Charlotte and Norman Sr. Norman was the third child and eldest son from a family of seven siblings living in Picayune, Mississippi. Picayune is the largest city in Pearl River County, with a population just shy of 11,000 residents. Located in southern Mississippi, Picayune is a small city covering 11 square miles comprised mostly of rural areas. While it may possess the isolated, homegrown small-town feel, it sits merely 45 miles from New Orleans to the south, making it a comfortable and quiet suburb to the hustle and bustle of busy city life. While the excitement of the city certainly had its appeal, for young Norman, it was always nature and the beautiful, sprawling land of Mississippi that drew his attention. The Ladner family owned a local store, out of which they operated every day. In addition to the store, the Ladners owned a large spread of 122 acres nearby, and for Norman, this was truly his playground. The land was fenced on all four sides, designating where the family's land ended and began. A young man with a drive for adventure and a love for the world around him, Norman had spent a great deal of his youth playing on that land, exploring it, learning each intricate detail about it. It was his home, after all. And as the years rolled through his youth, Norman would come to know the area like the back of his hand. The land was comprised of a lot of flat, open pastures and contrasted by thick wooded sections. According to Senior, approximately 65 acres were dense forestry, and while it could be possible to get lost, his son had spent so much time wandering the wooded paths that he could find his way in and out without the slightest doubt of where he might be. Outside of his love for the wilderness, Norman enjoyed working with his hands. From a young age, he wanted to construct items, to learn to work wood. In fact, Norman possessed so much talent, drive, and skill when it came to woodworking and construction that his parents actually allowed him to create a workshop for himself in the family barn. It wasn't uncommon to find Norman spending countless hours shaping, working, and constructing. It also wasn't uncommon for one of his parents to have to step into the barn and let him know that he'd been out there for hours, and he needed to get to bed so he could attend school that day. By 1989, Norman was 17 years old and attending high school, where he was going to become a senior. While he was smart and did well in school, it was clear to most that he wasn't driven to study his nights away and would rather get his hands on something, to work with his body rather than his mind. He kept his grades where they needed to be, but he certainly wasn't pursuing high honors, and when it came to conversations about college, well, Norman thought he'd probably just work for the family, and if not, maybe attend a trade school and sharpen up his skills for a job closer to his heart. Norman was, by all accounts, a very driven and passionate young man, but his parents had done a great job in raising him to be a respectful, polite, and helpful person as well. He loved the idea of being able to assist others, and whenever he had the chance, he'd lend a hand. In a way, being the eldest son, Norman took on the responsibility of looking out for his siblings. He found it necessary to be there for them, to stand up for them, to offer them protection, advice, whatever they might need. Most people tend to agree that Norman took pride in being this strong and dependable member of his family, and that word comes up often when you're talking about Norman. Dependable. He was someone who would always be there, and if he said he was going to do something, he would do it. If he said he'd be there for you, there was no doubt that he was going to be there. He was simply a sharp and kind young man who had the world in the palm of his hand. He could be quiet and reserved, but for the most part, Norman showed a zest for life and a deep-seated passion for helping others. Like many other boys his age, living in the rural area, Norman had a passion for hunting. His mother, Charlotte, would later say, quote, "He loved to fish, he loved to hunt, he loved to be among the wild animals. He would come back just so excited when he would see a young deer in the back pasture. It was just his fascination and love of being out there where it was peaceful and quiet." End quote. During the summer, Norman would sit down to breakfast with his family, and without surprise, most days his plans would involve heading out into the family's land. He'd spend his entire day out there, whether he was on the hunt or simply exploring the vast beauty of it all. He returned every day, usually between 7 and 7:30 p.m. You could almost set your watch by his comings and goings with how punctual he was. And that's a word that also comes up a lot. Punctual. He was not often late. Some days, when returning, he'd stop by the family store where he'd help his mother and father close up, restock the coolers, and get ready for the next day's business. The afternoon of August 21st, 1989 was a fairly typical one. It was a bright, warm day with clear skies, and Norman had decided, as per usual, that he was going to spend his day wandering through the woods and maybe get in a little hunting. Norman walked away from his family's store that day with plans to return around his usual time. With him, he carried his rifle, and in his pocket was his wallet, containing his driver's license and a sum totaling $140 in cash. On this particular day, something would go terribly wrong, and Norman would not return. Senior worked throughout the day without giving it a second thought. But when 7 p.m. rolled around and Norman hadn't returned, he became somewhat worried. Norman wasn't necessarily going to stroll back in at exactly 7, but as the clock moved ahead towards 7:30, Senior began to think that something could be wrong. It was highly unlike his son to not be back by then. He decided that maybe something had kept him late, or he'd already left the woods and gone back to the barn to do some woodwork. Senior locked up the store and drove over to the barn. When he arrived, he called out Norman's name and made his way inside, but it was clear that wherever Norman was, he hadn't been to the barn that day. Senior rushed back to the store, at which time he picked up the phone and called Charlotte. According to Senior, he explained that Norman hadn't yet returned and he was concerned that something may have happened to him. At the time, they considered the possibility that Norman may have gotten lost as the night had begun to grow dark, or perhaps had injured himself and was unable to make the trek back out of the woods. The family's land had wild animals on it, and so the idea that Norman may have been bitten by a snake or simply injured himself wasn't out of the question. Senior decided to contact a few friends and organize a search party. They would enter the woods with flashlights and call out Norman's name, hoping to locate him. Charlotte planned to assist in the search, but during the early stages of it, made the decision to go back to the store and wait on the chance that Norman might find his way there. Charlotte later explained, quote, "I helped to some degree in the search, but then I decided it would be best that I waited for him at the store. Perhaps if he could come to the store, or if he was limping from a snake bite or whatever, he would come to the store first, and I felt my place should be there." End quote. Senior headed out into the woods with the family dog and a friend. Though the exact time wasn't noted, it's believed that the search kicked off sometime between 8 and 8:30 p.m., 30 minutes to an hour after Norman would normally have returned home. In the dark of night, with only flashlights, the dense forestry provided a suitable challenge to those searching. Once deep enough into the timber and foliage, it was incredibly difficult to determine which direction to go or where they'd already been. The men spent over an hour shouting for Norman and combing every inch of the land they could find, finding themselves getting deeper and deeper into the darkness. With each passing minute, and with no answers from Norman, Senior was growing more worried. It became clear to him at this time that something was horribly wrong, but he could not have been prepared for the terrible discovery he would make. Shortly before 10 p.m., Senior and his friends split up to cover more area. Senior didn't make it much further until he quickly began shouting for his friend to come to him. There, in a clearing beside a tree, Senior found the lifeless body of his 17-year-old son. Norman was laid on his back, head cocked to the left, with his left hand resting on his abdomen, right arm outstretched. His legs were both bent at the knee, with his left foot beneath his right knee. His rifle, with the barrel broken from the stock, was laying not far from his boots. Getting down quickly, Senior reached out and laid his hands on Norman, but found his body cold to the touch, indicating that he had likely died hours earlier. Senior later explained, quote, "It's a deep shock and a tragedy to come upon your own son, because you could never imagine or think how this could happen, or the loss of a child, until you've experienced going through it." End quote. While Senior stayed with his son, the friend exited the woods to call the police. It was the Pearl River County Sheriff's Department who would respond, then under the command of Sheriff Lawrence Lumpkin. The scene itself was difficult due to being so dark and hard to view. Utilizing flashlights and portable lamps, authorities examined the scene to the best of their ability. Norman had died due to a single gunshot wound to the head, with the bullet entering through his right temple and exiting his left. Later examination by the medical examiner would find forensics indicating that, at the time the shot was fired, the barrel of the gun was no more than 2 inches from Norman's head. Back at the scene, the first thought investigators had was that it must have been an accident. With Norman's body's proximity to a nearby tree, authorities put forth the theory that Norman may have been in the tree, lost his grip and fallen to the ground, at which time the rifle may have discharged and fatally struck him. The condition of the rifle at the scene has been somewhat debated, though all evidence seems to indicate that it was broken when recovered. There was, however, some evidence on the rifle that it had been broken in the past and repaired. This, of course, raised the question of whether or not the rifle could have been fired and killed Norman before breaking, if indeed he had fallen out of a tree. In terms of the possibility of foul play, Sheriff Lumpkin felt this wasn't a possibility, later stating, quote, "Foul play is the first thing that I normally address in the course of an investigation. I ruled it out in this instance because I saw nothing there to indicate that." End quote. Not long after the sheriff's department cordoned off the area and began their investigation, the coroner arrived to confirm the death. Initially, he agreed with investigators that it seemed like an accident. Norman was loaded into an ambulance to be driven back to town, where a full medical examination would be conducted. Due to the scene being in the middle of the woods, low light, and a belief fairly quickly that the death was accidental and not related to a homicide, a thorough investigation of the surrounding area was not conducted at that time. In essence, and according to Norman's family, once the decision had been made that Norman's death was accidental, investigators didn't deem it necessary to go further in terms of examining the scene, nor seeking out additional evidence. They did not search for the bullet, nor did they fingerprint the rifle. At the scene, it was discovered that Norman's wallet and the $140 he had was missing, but investigators had no explanation for this, nor did they seek one. Shortly after Norman was removed from the woods, a sheriff's deputy made the trip to the family store, where he broke the news to Charlotte that they had found her son deceased. Charlotte was unprepared for the horrible news and was absolutely shattered by it, unsure of what to think or do. Both Norman's parents believed that it had been a tragic accident, as had been stated by the sheriff and the coroner, though the final report would deal another devastating blow to their already broken family. The coroner's examination of Norman's body didn't reveal a great deal of evidence. It was clear that he had died as the result of a gunshot wound to the right temple, and the only other damage discovered was a 1 1/4 inch cut on the crown of his head. At the time, there was no indication what may have caused the cut, though it was considered a possibility that Norman may have struck a rock or tree root when he had fallen to the ground. This detail, though, would be hotly debated by the family later. After completion of the examination, the coroner paid a visit to the Ladner family at their store and went over his findings. According to Senior, during that conversation, the coroner expressed that he had a 90% certainty that the death was accidental and planned to rule it as such. While this was heartbreaking news, It gave the family a certain level of comfort and closure as to what may have happened to Norman. However, days later, when the official report was released, the cause of death was not listed as accidental, but instead classified as death by suicide. The medical examiner would later explain that the close proximity of the gun to Norman's skull when fired was inconsistent with an accident, and it was more likely that, when fired, the gun had been nearly touching him, and the belief was that Norman had taken his own life. The Ladner family was absolutely blindsided by the suicide ruling and strongly disagreed with it. In their minds, Norman had ever been a bright, happy, and optimistic young man who loved life and lived it to the fullest. He had plans for the future, dreams, and aspirations, and he had never said anything to indicate to them that he might be depressed or contemplating suicide. The police and the medical examiner felt that their findings were solid, supported by evidence, and, according to the Ladners, they were brushed aside and treated as grieving parents who simply couldn't accept the truth about what had happened. While it isn't uncommon for families to disagree with suicide rulings, authorities were not open to discussing the case further and began to actively avoid conversation with the Ladners, even going so far as to abruptly explain to them that their son had committed suicide and they needed to accept it and move on with their lives. Sheriff Lumpkin later stated, quote, "The results of that autopsy is what I based my findings as to believing that it was a self-inflicted wound. I think that he went back into an area where he felt comfortable, he enjoyed going, and for reasons that we don't know, that he decided to take his life. We believe the boy was standing when the shot was fired because of his body position in relation to the gun at the scene." End quote. In the immediate aftermath of this declaration, the Ladner family didn't know what to do. Unfortunately, while struggling with this horrible information, they were simultaneously planning their beloved son's funeral. Norman was laid to rest in Turtle Skin Cemetery in his hometown. A tombstone, decorated ornately with a lake, log cabin, mountains, and wild animals, was set into place and reads in part, "His life was full of loving deeds, forever thoughtful of others' needs, generous and kind in all of his ways, upright and just to the end of days. Beloved son and big brother." After being left reeling from the loss and overwhelmed by the pain and confusion, Senior and Charlotte discussed the situation. At the time, Charlotte felt that it was still possible that Norman may have died due to an accident, but Senior felt something more sinister may have occurred. Spurned on by their feelings and frustrated with the investigation and its findings, or lack thereof, the Ladner family made the choice to investigate for themselves. The first move was to re-examine the scene where Norman's body had been found. Looking around, setting markers where he had been lying, they looked over the medical examiner's report. The first place they found a problem was with the cut on the back of Norman's head. The coroner and a pathologist had determined that, there in the earth, a jagged root had been found with blood on it. It was their argument that Norman had hit his head on this root, and that's what had caused the injury. The problem for the Ladners, though, was that the cut ran an inch and a quarter, and part of that cut climbed towards the top of Norman's head. While it seemed entirely possible to them that he could have hit his head on the root, they felt it wouldn't have caused damage found towards the top of his head. In a later interview, Senior explained that Norman could have hit the back of his head, or the side, but not the peak of it. It was at this time that they made the decision that, to figure out exactly what had occurred, they would need to find the bullet that investigators had never searched for. The Ladners spent several days digging up sections of the earth and sifting through it using screens and small tools. They began as close to where Norman's body had been and slowly spun their way outward. It didn't take very long. After removing a shovel full of dirt located directly beneath where Norman's head had been, still soaked with his dried blood, they saw a metallic glint. There, in the soil, they recovered a bullet stained with blood and with hair attached to it. Almost immediately, Senior was disturbed by what they had found. The bullet itself was longer than he'd expected, and it was his belief that this particular shell couldn't have been loaded and fired from Norman's gun. It was a high caliber, and it simply wouldn't have fit. The second detail that caught his attention was the location. For this bullet to have been the one which had killed Norman, it would suggest that he had had to have been lying down at the time the bullet was fired. If he had been standing, as authorities believed, the bullet would have traveled further away from the scene and been recovered elsewhere. This bullet, though, appeared to have passed through something with blood and hair and impacted directly into the ground, implying it was fired in a downward trajectory, not a sideways trajectory, as would be consistent with Norman standing and pulling the trigger himself. The Ladners went down to the sheriff's department with the bullet and confronted investigators, but again, they were met with a cold shoulder. Due to the fact that the parents themselves had found it and had brought it to the police, authorities felt there was no way to confirm that this was the bullet that had killed Norman, nor could they say with certainty where it had been found. Investigators argued that Norman had been standing when he died, and that a bullet found in the dirt beneath his head would not have any connection to the crime itself. Charlotte, however, believed that Norman may likely have been lying down at the time he was killed, and for her, the discovery of the bullet and its location indicated clearly that this had been no accident, and that her son was likely murdered by an unknown individual. Frustrated with the sheriff's department, the Ladners reached out to a state ballistics expert. He agreed to examine the bullet, though ultimately his examination was inconclusive. He could neither say whether the bullet had been fired from Norman's gun or not, and he could not determine if it indeed was the bullet that took Norman's life. After the results of this analysis, the family requested that the bullet be returned to them so they might have it examined elsewhere. The bullet was sent back. But according to the family, the bullet they received was not the one they had sent out. Senior stated that the bullet was longer and had a nick in it and blood and hair on it. The bullet they received back was cleaned, shorter, and had no nicks or damage. It was Senior's belief that something foul was going on, and that the bullet they believed was involved in their son's death had been purposefully swapped out for a different one. Feeling that something wasn't right with this situation, the Ladners' next choice was to visit the medical examiner. They hoped to debate the finer points of the autopsy with him, to discuss the bullet they'd found, and while they didn't think they'd get him to force the case to be reopened, they did believe there was enough contradictory information to get the cause of death changed from suicide to accident, or possibly even unknown. They believed that by getting the report changed, they could have some leverage against the sheriff's department to reopen the investigation, or at least force them to have a more comprehensive discussion about the events of the day Norman was found. It was at the coroner's office where Charlotte would later claim she had an incredibly odd encounter. While standing beside Senior and speaking with the coroner, Charlotte alleges that a man approached her from behind. The man reached out and touched Charlotte's arm, getting her attention. When she turned to him, the man, who was dressed in a nice suit and looked well put together, asked her if she could come with him for a moment and talk. When Charlotte asked what he wanted to talk about, he supposedly explained that he wanted to discuss Norman. Charlotte stepped away with the man while Senior remained talking to the coroner. After walking a short distance, Charlotte claims the man drew her into a corner and delivered what she believed to be a threat. In her own words, Charlotte explained, quote, "As we were a distance away, he said, 'Miss Ladner, don't open this case up. You have other children. I suggest you raise them for your own good. You'll never find the person that killed your son.'" End quote. At this time, she says the man turned and walked away, and she never saw him again. Charlotte went back to Senior at this time and told him what had happened. But the man was gone, and no one seemed to know who he was or where he could have gone. In fact, outside of Charlotte, nobody even reported seeing this particular man. While others have been dismissive of this detail, feeling it's highly unlikely that this man was just waiting around the coroner's office for a chance to warn them, the Ladiners themselves believed it was yet another piece of the puzzle in helping them find the truth, that their son had been murdered rather than committing suicide. Unfortunately, the coroner remained steadfast in his final ruling and informed the family that he wouldn't be changing the cause of death, as he felt there wasn't enough evidence available to change his findings. At this time, Senior began growing somewhat paranoid and found himself walking into the woods every day, looking for clues and information that could lead to the truth about his son. On one particular trip, he found something he believed suggested that there was more going on with this case than he had previously been told. Using the location of Norman's body as a starting point, Senior began walking out in all directions from that central point, hoping that he might find something, anything, to indicate the reason his son had been murdered. On one of those trips, Senior made a discovery some 300 yards from the scene of Norman's death. Hanging from a piece of wire in a nearby tree, Senior found an electronic device. The device itself was encased in two pieces of a gray shell held together with several loops of tape. The device had what appeared to be a radio antenna jutting out from the top of it. It was clear that the device had been handmade, though there were no buttons or dials on it. Unsure of what he had found, Senior once again returned to the sheriff's department. Without looking too long, nor giving a great deal of consideration, Senior was told they didn't know what the device was, but they didn't think it bore any connection to Norman's death. Again, in their minds, this was a clear-cut case of suicide, and the case was closed. Once more feeling that they were being ignored, the Ladiners spoke to a neighbor about the case and the item they had found. This neighbor put them in touch with a former DEA agent who had retired and was now living in the area. According to Senior, when he explained the scenario of Norman's death to the man, the former agent felt that it didn't seem like a suicide, and he had difficulty understanding why authorities had wrapped it up so tightly and wouldn't venture back into it. When Senior showed him the device, the DEA agent recognized it immediately. According to Senior, the man explained that this particular device was used in drug smuggling. It was a radio transmitter that sent out a beacon. Drug smugglers would fly low over specific areas, and when the beacon was picked up by their equipment, it would signal them to drop a shipment of drugs down into the area for pickup. Armed with this information, Senior began to wonder if it was possible that Norman had come across drug smugglers in the woods that day and been murdered after witnessing their operation. Despite this information, authorities remained firm on their determination. Sheriff Lumpkin later stated, quote, "I don't think that's what happened in this case. It's very difficult to accept a death, period. It's that much harder to accept a suicide. It's my feeling that if this case was ruled an accidental death today, they would say nothing else about it." End quote. The rift between investigators and the family created a slow-burning firestorm of rumors and speculation. Townsfolks all over were talking about the Dixie Mafia, a tightly connected organization of criminals operating in Mississippi at the time. They were connected to all manner of illegal activities, including drug smuggling and murder. This, though, by many, was considered an unlikely connection. There is one other bizarre detail related to this case, though I must preface this by saying, despite my sincerest efforts, I've been unable to verify this officially. According to several news articles, sometime after Norman's death, his driver's license was recovered. Remember, his wallet was not found with his body. According to these articles, of all places, Norman Ladner's ID was recovered in New York State. Again, no official statements from authorities, nothing to verify this claim, but if true, it would certainly lend credence to the argument that Norman's death may not have been a mere accident or suicide. Residents of the town began to wonder if it was possible that drug smugglers were operating in their area, and if so, Whether or not the sheriff's department may have been involved in those activities and assisting in covering them up. There were some in town who claimed to have seen a small, single-engine plane flying low in the area the day Norman died, though this has never been verified either. Some have even suggested that Sheriff Lumpkin himself may have been involved in some illegal activities, though no one ever made a direct connection that could be proved between he and narcotics trafficking, though there was conversation about Lumpkin taking kickbacks from dealers. The most I could find that could be verified was that Lumpkin had at some point been involved in illegal gambling related to dogfighting. On the other side of the coin, there were those who were looking sideways at Senior. Whispers in the town suggested that Senior himself may have been involved in the drug trade, and that Norman wandered into something he shouldn't have seen and paid the ultimate price. There have even been rumors that Norman wasn't alone the day he was murdered, and that another boy had been with him and escaped. But again, all of this comes down to pure speculation, with none of it being officially reported or verified. Some believe there may be a connection between Norman Ladner's death and the famous Boys on the Tracks case, though the two locations are separated by more than 700 miles. However, the concept of a cover-up by law enforcement to protect a smuggling operation certainly provides enough intrigue for many to believe in this possibility. Sadly, Norman's case essentially stopped there. There was never another investigation into his death, and for years his family struggled to grasp what may have happened. The tension surrounding his death and the overwhelming grief that the family experienced ultimately led to a total breakdown. Just a few years after Norman died, Senior and Charlotte filed for divorce. They simply couldn't move on from what had occurred, and the frustration and pain surrounding the loss of their son had irrevocably damaged their relationship. Separated, the two went their own ways, though they never gave up on determining what had truly happened to their son. As the years passed, they continued seeking answers, fighting for justice, but they were never able to get their hands on enough evidence for anyone to take their beliefs seriously. The case was officially closed, but for the Ladners it never would be, not until they knew the truth. Unfortunately, with no one officially looking into it, it began to grow cold, and there was only so much two civilians could do to raise awareness or to investigate. As the years continued passing, Norman's name began to fade from the news, and soon, the only ones who remembered him or questioned what had happened were those who knew and loved him. 14 years later, in 2003, Senior passed away and was buried beside Norman, with his name etched onto the right side of the tombstone. He went to his death fighting and believing that his son had been murdered, and that the answers were out there somewhere. Charlotte and Norman's siblings are still alive, and though while they believe foul play was involved, so many years have gone by that there is little which can be done. Even if they wanted to have the case reopened, there is almost nothing left they could provide as evidence outside of their own thoughts and experiences. Sheriff Lumpkin himself passed away just a few years after Senior in 2007. In a case which spans nearly 30 years, and for which there is hardly any hard evidence available, there have been a great number of theories suggested. Most of these theories, though, fall under the banner of three distinct possibilities. The first theory suggests that the official findings are correct, that Norman Ladner, for reasons unknown, made the terrible decision to end his own life while walking through the very fields and woods that he loved so dearly, on his family's own property. The second theory follows the original thought process that perhaps Norman's death may have been nothing more than a terribly tragic accident. Those who support this theory believe that Norman either fell from a tree or perhaps stumbled and accidentally discharged his rifle, taking his own life by sheer accident. The third and final theory, as purported by Norman's family, argues the possibility that 17-year-old Norman Ladner may have come across something he wasn't meant to see. Whether it was a drug smuggling operation or some other illegal activity, and that when he discovered what was going on in the area and was found himself, the choice was made to kill him rather than allowing a possible witness to escape. The death of Norman Ladner is a terribly sad story, no matter which way you look at it. A 17-year-old, close with his family, tight with his friends, with a zest for life and a love of adventure, wanders off into the woods, just like any other day. But this time, he doesn't come home. His own father makes the grisly discovery, and is faced with the overwhelming pain and sorrow of having to bury his eldest son. Norman's mother was utterly shattered by this discovery, and while she may have been able to come to terms with it being an accident, the suicide ruling changed everything. It's been 29 years since Norman Ladner was found in the woods near his home. If alive today, Norman would be 46. Perhaps a father, a husband, he could have been anything. All of that was erased when this terrible incident took place. For authorities, it's a clear-cut case of suicide, and a family that cannot accept the painful truth about their son and their brother. For the Ladners, it was never a matter of accepting the suicide theory, because there simply wasn't enough evidence to prove that, and to them, Norman would never have taken his own life. The discovery of the bullet, the radio transmitter, and the bizarre man who threatened Charlotte solidified in their minds that Norman had been murdered, and the police either didn't care or were complicit in covering up that terrible crime. When asked about Norman's death and her determination to find the truth, Charlotte responded, quote, "We have to proceed. We will not stop this investigation, no matter what, until it's finished. We owe it to our son, and we owe it to our children. We owe it to ourselves, and we owe it to other people's children out there as well. We want to know what happened to our son." The death of Norman Ladner is one of those cases that stuck with me since childhood. I was 7 years old when Norman was found, and while I wasn't aware of the case at the time, I learned about it through Unsolved Mysteries. The show ran an episode covering this case in 1990, just a year after the tragic incident had taken place. It was, in a way, one of those stories that shattered my innocent view of the world and allowed me to see that terrible things could happen, even to teenagers. While I wasn't fully able to comprehend it at the time, I remembered the story, and specific images from the show stuck in my mind, as I'm sure is true of everyone who watched while Robert Stack delivered these absolutely disturbing and haunting stories. There's something about a case that involves a younger individual that just bothers me, and Norman's case is no different. While authorities felt that this was a cut-and-dry case where a 17-year-old chose to end his own life, it's difficult to ignore all of the other information that seems to contradict that theory, or at least lends itself to other possible situations. I've always been disturbed by how quickly this case was wrapped up, and the resistance on the part of law enforcement when it came to opening it back up. Unfortunately, this case is fraught with contradictory information, debated evidence, and the conflict between the official story and the theories that dispute it. While it's easy to get caught up in all of that, at the core of this story, it's important to remember that a 17-year-old lost his life, whether by his own hand or not, and the shockwaves of that horrible incident forever destroyed a family, haunted a town, and left his parents grieving and wondering what the truth might be. As is often the case in a situation such as this, theories rise up and try to fill in the gaps. In Norman's case, we have three which have been purported over the years. Some from law enforcement, some from his family, and others which have simply come as the result of rumor and speculation throughout the town and across internet message boards over the past 29 years. The first of these theories is the official story, as determined by investigators, that Norman Ladner's death was a sad and tragic case of suicide. Suicide is certainly a difficult topic to examine, and while one may feel compelled to seek out other options, there's a lot here which has to be weighed. The primary forces fighting against this ruling were Norman's parents, And while we may empathize with them and try to understand their pain and grief, it isn't all that uncommon for parents to have a great deal of difficulty accepting that one of their children might choose to end his own life. There is so much speculation and misinformation out there when it comes to suicide. Many people believe that there are obvious signs. Others feel that everyone who is going to end their own life is going to seem extremely depressed and likely leave a note behind, but that isn't always the case. In fact, at least in regard to the note theory, studies show that only 10 to 38% of people who commit suicide actually leave a note behind. It's important to state that this incident took place in 1989. Not to say that the common understanding of mental health issues has dramatically increased, but even just as recently as the late 1980s, things were very different. There weren't as many discussions about teen suicides, there wasn't as much knowledge available about the signs or indicators, and even if there were, not everyone who's going to make such a terrible choice is going to telegraph it by displaying outward behavior indicative of depression. And even if they did, not everyone's going to pick up on that. Depression, especially that which is extreme enough to lead an individual to contemplate suicide, can often be a lot more difficult to detect than most people imagine. As someone who personally suffers from depression, most people in my life have absolutely no idea, and the people who I have told are usually surprised to discover this. It all depends how much you're paying attention, if you know what to look for, and frankly, whether or not the individual is willing to let others see it, or if they've become skilled at concealing that part of their life. By all accounts, in regard to Norman, he seemed like a happy and positive young man. His parents spoke very highly of his attitude, he was devoted to his family, working hard to assist his parents and siblings. He loved woodworking, wandering the woods, hunting, fishing, and all manner of activities that got him out into the world where he might experience a little fun. I've read accounts from friends who referred to Norman as a prankster, someone who would always make them laugh and who wasn't above walking into school with some fake vomit to gross out the girls and get his buddies chuckling. While he could be quiet and reserved, he also had a boisterous personality that drew attention, and he just had a way with people that made them want to be around him. While all of that may be true, we've certainly seen examples in recent years of celebrities who outwardly appeared to be happy. They seemed like they had it all and were willing to connect with others, while internally they were struggling with the darkness of depression that ultimately got a hold of them and wouldn't let go. After all of this time, it's impossible to psychoanalyze Norman, and I certainly wouldn't be the right person to conduct that kind of an analysis, and so we have to examine what we do know. According to the official theory, Norman made the decision at some point that he was going to walk into the woods that he loved so much, on his family's property, and end his own life. The sheriff's department and medical examiner believe that Norman, upon finding a spot he felt would serve his purpose, raised his rifle up, pressed the barrel to his right temple, and pulled the trigger. At this time, the gun would have fallen to the earth, breaking along a line where it had been previously repaired, and in the aftermath of the shot, Norman may have fallen and the back of his head collided with a sharp tree root which was jutting out from the earth. It certainly seems plausible, but certain questions have been raised. The physical act of holding a rifle to one's temple is, to say the least, awkward, and to say the most, not the easiest way to accomplish the task. Norman would have had to have extended his right arm out fully to reach the trigger, while his left arm crossed his body and supported the barrel so that it was lined up with his temple. Many have wondered why, if indeed Norman was making the choice to end his own life, he wouldn't have chosen the easier options of placing the gun beneath his chin or even in his own mouth. It's difficult to know why he'd have chosen to have done it this way, but many feel that it seems extremely strange that he would have elected to utilize the rifle in this fashion when there were easier and quicker ways. The positioning of his body has also been debated in terms of this choice, with many believing that had Norman fired the gun in this manner, his body would have fallen off towards the left rather than straight backwards. The fact of the matter is, we simply can't know this for certain. The way Norman was found, he was on his back with his head turned to the left, which does seem to go along with the theory that he may have been standing and fired the bullet from right to left. The way a body falls, the trajectory a bullet follows, these are not always cut and dry determinations. Bullets can do bizarre things when they collide with bone. Bodies can contort themselves into strange positions at the moment of death. With all of that being said, one key point has been the cut on the back of Norman's head. Some believe it's simply not possible that he could have received that cut merely by falling. The cut itself is difficult to discuss. The medical examiner listed as being on the crown of the head. Determining the exact location defined as the crown can be a little frustrating, as I've seen it exemplified as everywhere from the back of the head to the top of the head. According to an anatomy textbook, however, the crown was described as meaning the top of the head, but it can also mean the whole head. That doesn't exactly provide a great deal of specification. Norman's father argued that the cut was on the back of the head, but that it spanned from the back of the head to the peak of his head. On the one hand, it certainly seems possible that the injury could have been received simply by Norman falling backwards, striking his head on a tree root or perhaps even a rock. On the other, one could argue that almost anything could have caused the injury. The presence of blood on the tree root, while intriguing, doesn't necessarily indicate that as the cause. A head wound produces a lot of blood, and even Norman's parents expressed that weeks later, the dirt they dug up was matted with his dried blood. The fact of the matter is, there simply isn't enough information available to know for certain. Investigators didn't pick the scene apart, they didn't look for the bullet, they didn't do much besides determine that it was likely an accident or suicide. Once the medical examiner concluded suicide, the sheriff's department went along with his findings, and in possession of no other evidence, this seemed a rather open and shut case. It wouldn't be until the Ladners themselves recovered a bullet and other items which seemed to contradict the official story that others began to wonder. That will all be addressed in another theory, but in terms of this specifically being a suicide, we simply can't know. I do believe there's enough here to question that finding, or to at least call for further investigation, but being that 29 years have passed, I'm not even sure what investigators would look into. The sheer fact of the matter is that suicide is a possibility which cannot be completely ruled out, though for most who examine the case, there does seem to be enough information to call it into question. When investigators first arrived, they considered the possibility that this may have been an accident, and that leads us to our second theory. Under this theory, Norman's death may have been a tragic accident. For years, people have debated the validity of this theory, and even investigators themselves considered it a possibility for a period of time. For some, though, it never made a lot of sense. The original concept was that Norman, at some point, had climbed into a tree along with his rifle, lost his footing, and fallen, at which time the rifle fell and discharged, hitting him with a fatal bullet. While this sounds plausible enough, when you examine the actual details of his death, it doesn't really match up too well. Firstly, there was no bruising on Norman's body. There was no damage to his bones. There was nothing to indicate that he had fallen out of a tree. Now, it's entirely possible he could have been climbing down when this happened, and so perhaps he wouldn't have hit the ground hard enough to leave any marks behind, but then again, there is the cut on the back of his head. Perhaps when Norman fell from the tree, he hit his head? Again, impossible to know, but honestly, it's not the logistics of the fall that call this theory into question for me, it's the gunshot wound itself. I've seen guns do bizarre things. I've been present when a gun misfires or fires when dropped. That's certainly a possibility, and considering the damaged condition that Norman's rifle was found in, it's not entirely impossible to consider the possibility that dropping his rifle may have caused it to fire, especially if it had been damaged in the past and was not properly fixed. All of that being said, what is the likelihood that Norman fell in such a way that the barrel of the rifle would have been lined up just inches from his right temple when fired, and how likely is it that this bullet would travel in a straight trajectory from his right temple through and exiting out his left temple? That seems like a really strange set of circumstances to come as the result of a fall. Just try to imagine that. Norman falls from a tree and lands perfectly with his right temple in line with the barrel of his rifle, which itself is apparently perfectly straight, and at the very moment the two are lined up, the rifle fires and Norman is killed by this fatal wound. Have you ever fallen out of a tree? Or seen someone fall out of anything? It's hardly a fluid motion, and even if you were aiming at someone falling out of a tree, you'd have a great deal of difficulty getting a clear shot off, let alone a through-and-through gunshot to the temple with a straight trajectory. So what if it wasn't the tree itself that he fell from, but perhaps stumbling across a root or tripping on a rock? Again, we're faced with a situation where this young boy would have fallen completely out of control, his rifle would have dropped from his hands, and yet still we're faced with a situation where this gun would have to fire and hit him perfectly, all while both he and the gun itself are flopping towards the ground, or perhaps already lying on it. Norman, though, was found on his back, not his chest, which to me would indicate that he wasn't walking forward when he fell, if that's what happened. The fact of the matter is, when it comes to this being accidental, there are few, if any, scenarios that can be presented that make much sense. The idea that anything accidentally occurred resulted in Norman receiving a clean shot to the temple just doesn't connect for most who examine this theory. Now, could Norman have been playing around and held the rifle to his own head and either thought it was empty or fired it by accident? Yeah, but a 17-year-old boy who's been using a rifle for a long period of time and is experienced enough to go hunting likely knows better than to point a gun at himself. When you're around guns, one of the first things you learn is to never point that gun at another person or yourself, because accidents can and will happen. While the accidental theory is certainly one which I can understand the consideration for, I tend to side with most people who have examined it that it seems to be the least likely possibility here. Yes, bizarre things can happen and life can be stranger than fiction, but this would almost have to be a perfect storm of strange things happening that result in Norman dying in this manner. Were the bullet wound elsewhere? Were the trajectory less clean? Were there other indications at the scene that a fall or a stumble had occurred? It would be considered a higher possibility. But given what we know, given all of the forensic evidence and the positioning of Norman's body, the accidental theory simply doesn't seem valid. So, if this wasn't a suicide and it wasn't an accident, what else could it have been? Well, the most popular theory in this case is that Norman was the victim of a homicide. That's what his parents believe, at least, and what others have suggested as the most likely scenario. In terms of this being a homicide, there are several details which have been used to support this theory. Firstly, the cut on Norman's head. Many people believe this may have been the result of someone striking him, perhaps even pistol-whipping him, or came as the result of a struggle with someone at the scene. Remember, when investigators arrived, it was dark, and they conducted their investigation by flashlight and lamp. They didn't return the next day when it was light out, though at the same time, Norman's family didn't report seeing any drag marks or anything at the scene which would indicate a scuffle had ensued. This leads many to believe that someone may have snuck up on Norman and struck him from behind. That's certainly a possibility to be considered. Moving forward, there's the bullet that was found. Now, the Ladners allege that this bullet was dug up from the earth beneath where Norman's head had been positioned. This would certainly indicate that Norman may have been lying on the ground when the fatal shot was fired, which would be consistent with someone striking him and knocking him to the earth first. Of course, there are issues with the bullet. We don't know what gun fired it. In fact, we don't even know that it was the bullet that passed through Norman's body. At the time, there was no DNA examination conducted. We don't know that the hair was kept as evidence, and if it was, nothing's ever been done with it. Remember, Norman used to hunt in those woods. It's entirely possible this could have been a bullet which had hit an animal, though Senior argued this particular bullet wouldn't have fit into his son's rifle. That was inconclusive when examined by the state. Either way, the bullet adds an intriguing layer, and while the state ballistics lab can't decide one way or the other, it does leave the possibility that this could have been the bullet that killed him. And if it was, then the story is extremely different from that which authorities have presented. For many, though, it's neither the bullet nor the cut which indicates foul play to them. It's Norman's wallet. According to his family, his wallet was with him and contained $140 cash and his driver's license. The wallet was never recovered or located, and the only information that has ever been revealed about its possible location is the rumor that Norman's ID was found in New York State, which again, I have been unable to independently verify. However, it does seem to suggest that someone else may have been present either during the time of Norman's death or sometime before his body was found, and that this person may have taken his wallet. I do find it strange that they'd hang on to his ID long enough to get it to New York, though. You'd imagine a killer would have simply taken the cash and thrown the wallet away elsewhere. The next piece we have to examine is the so-called radio transmitter. If I'm being honest, this is one piece of evidence I have a lot of issues with. Everything about this device revolves around the alleged word of a former DEA agent who was never identified. It just seems bizarre that a former DEA agent would recognize this device, explain exactly what it was, but not participate in any way to assist the Ladners in talking to the local police. Now, there could have been a lot of reasons why this occurred. Maybe the agent didn't want to get involved. But were that the case, why did he allow the Ladners into his home in the first place? This also goes in line with the man who allegedly threatened Charlotte at the coroner's office. These are two really intriguing individuals and details about the case, which can ultimately only be verified by the Ladners themselves. I wouldn't suggest that these stories aren't true, or that the Ladners would fabricate these individuals, but it's really difficult to work with this information. If Charlotte was threatened, if the radio transmitter did indeed exist, this suggests that foul play was involved and her son was murdered. If the police were given this information and chose not to act on it, I can absolutely understand the family feeling like they may have been involved in a cover-up or complicit in the crime, but again, we simply don't know. I've read all manner of rumor and speculation about the sheriff's department and Sheriff Lumpkin himself, but who knows what there is really true? If you're going by sheer evidence alone, Sheriff Lumpkin had an exemplary career and was never involved in any trouble. If you go by rumor, he was a cop on the take who was involved in brutal tactics and didn't consider it beyond possibility to cover up murders and drug deals. When you put it all into perspective, what do you really have? A bullet, which may or may not have been involved in Norman's death. An alleged radio transmitter used by drug smugglers. A cut on the back of Norman's head, which either suggests falling down or being struck. A broken rifle, which either fired a perfectly deadly shot before breaking, or which was broken without being fired at all. An unidentified man who warns Charlotte not to look into the case and, in a passive manner, threatens her other children. A missing wallet and cash, which are never recovered. And a family fighting against a sheriff's department for the truth about what may or may not have happened to their son. It's a mess, to put it simply. The drug smuggler theory has been supported by a lot of people, though none of which have been able to provide solid evidence. Locals have suggested that it was known that drugs were being run through the area, that some local law enforcement may have been involved in covering it up, and I've even read accounts where some have gone far enough to suggest that Sheriff Lumpkin was arresting drug dealers to open up business for other drug dealers, in whose employ he worked, by receiving cash in brown paper bags at discreet locations. While that all sounds intriguing, there's really nothing to support it. Unfortunately, though, we have seen instances where things like this go on, and it isn't entirely impossible in this case. So this theory suggests that Norman, while wandering through the woods as he often did, came upon something he wasn't meant to see. Most people believe that this was a drug smuggler picking up a package dropped from an airplane utilizing one of those radio transmitters. That's entirely possible, but I have some issues with it. Norman was in these woods almost every day, but there has never been a single account of him seeing anyone who didn't belong there, let alone anyone smuggling drugs in the past. It seems rather strange that this spot could be used without him noticing previously. Senior never saw anyone on his property doing this, and even after finding the radio transmitter, it's not as though he ever saw anything like this again. It seems unlikely that this would be a one-time thing. If the smugglers went far enough to utilize the radio transmitter in that area, you'd think they have done it again, or possibly before. There could be a lot of different scenarios leading up to someone killing Norman in the woods that day. Drug smuggling seems to be the most prominent possibility, and most people tie it into the sheriff's department being corrupt, but we honestly don't know. It's a possibility that someone committed this terrible crime and robbed a family of their eldest son and stole Norman's life from him for reasons we may never know. In doing so, whoever committed this crime not only took Norman's life, but then reached out, emptied the young man's pockets and walked away with his money in a last cold act of robbery after murder. Perhaps even robbery could have been the motive. Someone wandering through the woods comes across a young kid, takes advantage of him, steals his wallet. Unfortunately, we simply don't know. When it comes down to this theory, and really all of the theories, and the possibility that Norman was murdered, it can't be ruled in or ruled out. Unfortunately, due to the nature of the investigation, the ruling of the medical examiner and the sheriff's department, and the utter lack of evidence available, the truth about what happened to Norman Ladner may never be fully known. Perhaps someone will come forward and reveal the truth, and be able to provide the information necessary to change the ruling, if indeed the ruling needs to be changed. Norman's father went to his grave, never knowing the truth about what happened to his son, and his mother today still wonders what Norman may have been doing with his life, were it not taken so needlessly and violently some 29 years ago. It's a terrible story, and at the end of it all, it really comes down to a question of what happened to Norman Ladner. Hopefully, someday, that answer will be revealed. If you're looking for more information about the mysterious death of Norman Ladner, there are many websites and forums which discuss his case. Unsolved Mysteries ran a segment on Norman's case in Season 3, Episode 10. If you have any information about the death of Norman Ladner, please contact the Pearl River County Sheriff's Department or the FBI. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. I want to give a special shout out to Patreon producers Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Kate Alexander, Lucy LaRue, Lynn Merschel, and Sarah Burrow. Make sure you check your emails, as I'm awaiting responses from several of you regarding your trace evidence gear. Your support makes this show possible. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, visit patreon.com/traceevidence. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings and reviews the show gets, the more people are able to hear these unsolved cases. For more information about other cases, transcripts, media, and more, please visit the website at trace-evidence.com. This completes this week's episode. I want to remind you that Trace Evidence is available on Spotify now, so make sure you go and check it out there. Also, please visit truecrimelist.com and give Trace Evidence a vote. It would certainly help grow the podcast, and I'd really appreciate it. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.